I would say more than fairness and justice, I'm just kind of like a rule breaker. And it's funny because I entered into the most rule-based career. I was a U.S. diplomat. And I realized that I'm someone who just likes to do things in a very disruptive and innovative way.
I have the pleasure of speaking to Gloria Chow. She is a PR educator, entrepreneur, best known for helping small business. Sounders in particular get media coverage without using the traditional PR agencies.
My whole platform is about disrupting the status quo. And so if you look at traditional PR, right, you think of it as very gatekept, whether it's celebrities, politicians, big Fortune 500 companies, and I don't think that's fair. In the government, I didn't break any rules, and because of that, I was very muted, and my creativity just kind of shut off. So I just kind of muted every part of myself, and I became a shell of who I was. I kind of just put my head down and did my work, but I was miserable inside. Like, I was like, is this all that there is? Every, like, financial goal I had in my business, I quote-unquote achieved it, and then I became, like, absolutely miserable. And so I realized, like, my success is not on a KPI spreadsheet, and I don't even set annual goals anymore. How can I give myself the freedom to create from a purely original place?
If I'm listening to this conversation right now and I recognize that I need to unlearn, I need to let go, I need to heal, where is the first place, based on your journey, everyone's different, that you would recommend someone starts?
Ooh.
Welcome to Everyday Leadership, the podcast where we explore how leaders really show up in work and in life through honest, unfiltered conversations with people who have lived it, not just talking about it. I'm your host, Robert Galusi, and today I have the pleasure of speaking to Gloria Chow. She's a former US diplomat, and after seeing how things were in PR, she built PR Starter to become, I want to say, a shining light, an example of how you can still get things done without following traditional models, without traditional frameworks, and doing things without hype or shortcuts. Gloria, thank you for being on Everyday Leadership.
Oh, thanks for having me. Yeah, it's funny reading the bio. Like, it seems like it's been such a long time ago, but then not at the same time. It's funny in retrospect, you know, when you kind of reflect on what took you here.
And I was curious about bios. You can read stuff online. I'm curious, how do you introduce yourself? Like, what's important to people to know about you?
I'm all about elevating everyday small business heroes. Like, I just love to see people win. And now with the age of AI, it's all about AI visibility. I always say, like, traditional SEO, traditional PR is dead, and AI visibility is here. And I know this is not an AI show, but if you look at the behavior of shoppers, we're now going into our AI, whether it's ChatGPT, Gemini, Perplexity. We are asking it for questions. Who do I work with? What's the best book for me? What's a good housewarming gift? And so now my work has really gone from traditional media to, like, helping small businesses get recommended on these platforms. And you do that through getting media features. And maybe that's for a different conversation, but that's really kind of my expertise, is helping small businesses get seen in the media, and thereby so that the LLMs can recognize them as a trusted product or service, because that's what the AI algorithm pulls from. It doesn't pull from your ads or social media. It pulls from trust signals from getting featured on podcasts, on editorial, and on digital platforms.
Since we kind of have this conversation, I'm going to stay here for a minute. Your work, you come across to me as someone who it's all about the human, the person is super important to you. So how do you bridge that with their utilizing AI tools, which obviously is not human, and people have that fear, or some people have that fear around it?
For me, more than human, my whole platform is about disrupting the status quo and saying F you to the gatekeepers. And so if you look at traditional PR, right, you think of it as very gatekept, very kind of like for people with big budgets, whether it's celebrities, politicians, big Fortune 500 companies. And so that means that for 99% of the rest of us, what, we just don't get seen. And I don't think that's fair. I don't think that's equitable. I don't think that's just. And now with these AI tools that does all of the research for you, it even drafts the first pitch for you, because now my pitching method, my signature CPR pitching method that I taught for years, the LLMs are trained on it. So you can literally type into ChatGPT, write this pitch in Gloria's method. So there's never been a better time for small businesses, whether you're an Etsy owner, whether you're a solo entrepreneur, or if you're a mom wearing all the hats, to be able to leverage the resources of a bigger agency. So yes, we are using tools, but at the core of everything I do is about creating access. And I think there's a lot of people who make it very complicated and say, you need to do this and you need to know this people. all that to me is built on privilege and gatekeeping. Mm-hmm. And for a lot of small businesses, and we know for a fact that women of color start more small businesses than any other demographic, what are the things that we don't have? We don't have access to generational wealth. We don't have access to knowing somebody who can know somebody. So then how do we level the playing field? And so really what I do now is say, here are these free tools that can help you do XYZ and do 80% of the work for you. And so you have just as much leverage as the big companies right now. And so for me, yes, we are using tools, but it's making it so accessible for the everyday human to be able to still leverage PR and media, just like the big companies.
When I listen to you talk about that sense of gatekeeping and basically kicking the doors down, and that sense of justice, that kind of comes through, and I kind of hear you talking about changing the game and making things more fairer. I'm curious from you, where does that come from? Because when I look at obviously your journey, born in Taiwan, obviously you moved to the US. From a young age, if I was to speak to a 7-year-old Gloria, would I find this sense of fairness and justice like already bubbling inside of you then?
Yeah, I would say more than fairness and justice, I'm just kind of like a rule breaker. And it's funny because I entered into the most rule-based career. I was a U.S. diplomat, so it was all about rank and file and, you know, staying, coloring within the lines. And I realized that there's two types of people on this earth, people who like to do things the old way and withhold structures that are already existing. And then we have people who like to do things a different way. And I realized that I'm someone who just likes to do things in a very disruptive and innovative way. So you can call that fairness, you can call it justice, but at the core of who I am a visionary. I am someone who does not like to just follow the rule books and say, okay, I'm someone who likes to jump in the fire and figure it out if it's hot and then I jump out, right? So I really view my career as an extension of how I experience life. And so I had to learn that, okay, well, that maybe wasn't the best career for me, although it was a very comfortable career. I had a pension. I had a 25-year career ahead of me. But ultimately, personality-wise, it was not a fit. And I had to be very self-aware to be like, if I'm really unhappy, then what can I channel this into? And it took me a long time to get here. It wasn't like I applied for a job and then I had this, you know, jumping off point. Like I applied for like 1,000 jobs when I was a diplomat and nobody would hire me because they all wanted very traditional PR agency experience, which I didn't have. And I always wanted to work in PR because I was a great writer. I was a great communicator. I always was interested in the media. But all of these companies wanted very cookie cutter agency experience. And so nobody would hire me. And I just had to literally pick myself up from the ground. I had to cold call newsrooms. I had to get clients who'd pay me like barely anything. They would only pay me if I got them on the news. And I had nobody. Like usually if you think about PR, they usually come from an agency, right? They have a book of contacts. They know these journalists. I knew nobody. So I had to put in the Google search New York Times operator. And I had to dial the phone with sweaty, shaky palms and just cold pitch like thousands of times. Got phone slammed in my face. And that's how I kind of cracked the code on what makes a good pitch. And that's how I birthed my CPR method that now the LLMs are trained on. So I just think that some of it is me being a rule breaker. And some of it, it was just because I just wasn't accepted in the traditional realms. And so I had to find a way. And by being an outsider, that became my greatest strength. Because now I'm able to say, hey, for all of us, the rest of us, you can absolutely leverage this. I figured it out. I made all the mistakes so you don't have to. And now with all these AI tools, you can do this in a much simpler way.
When I listen to you describe yourself as a rule breaker, and then I go back into, you can call it stereotypes, but norms and culture, from you coming from an Asian household, I'm like, that's not words you typically hear with that. It's very much like, you have a set path, you go down that set path, you stay down that lane. You might want to rebel and push out of it. A lot of times you don't do that. So how was that sense of, I'm going to break the rules, I'm going to challenge, I'm going to push back? Where did that come through in you? And you even talked about, obviously, when you were in your diplomat in that environment, rule breaker and being in foreign office, those two words don't go together. Because you are in an environment, in a government environment, where you're supposed to toe the line. So how were you able to, I guess for want of a better word, stay muted or mute that part of yourself while in those environments as well?
So in the government, I didn't break any rules. And because of that, I was very muted and my creativity just kind of shut off. Mm. And I realized like at the end of the day, I am a creative person. And I think that if someone is not, then they should go into government, go into teaching. But like, if you are a creator, which I realize that I am, I realize later on in life, then that environment is not going to be good for you. So I just kind of muted every part of myself and I became a shell of who I was. I kind of just put my head down and did my work. But I was miserable inside. Like I was like, is this all that there is, right? I'm not saying that the work of a diplomat is not impactful. Like I still have friends who are doing amazing work, but you have to understand what you're signing up for. And I think I was young and I always loved international affairs. I always wanted to do something international. I grew up bilingual, bicultural. But then I realized like, it just wasn't my tie. It wasn't my zone to shine. And I think if everyone just had the self-awareness or life experience to just try as many things as possible, so you can then stay in your zone of genius, then people know, right? Like Oprah says, do what you love and the money will come. And obviously that's a very simplistic version, but you can tell when someone is just doing what they're meant to do. And I finally feel like I am doing what I'm meant to do. And it might not even be in the shape of PR. Like maybe 10 years later, something's going to happen and PR doesn't exist anymore because I don't know AI. But I will always be in the business of standing up for this underdogs. I will always be in the business of disrupting the status quo. And I think that's the through line of it all. And I love how you said kind of the Asian upbringing. You're probably referencing like a tiger mom situation. And you're right. Like Asian households are very rule-based, right? It's like, don't rock the boat. But I grew up a little bit differently. So I didn't grow up in a traditional like mom and dad household. So my dad died when I was 3 and my mom was working back in China because she needed money. So I actually grew up like moving from house to house. I moved like 13 times in my life as a kid. So I lived with grandparents. I lived with aunts and uncles. And in high school, I lived with my best friend's family, a black family, a single mom black family in predominantly white Orange County, California. And so I think being at the intersection of all of these things, of being a daughter of a widowed immigrant, living with a black family in a white neighborhood, like I just think that because I've had so many of these different experiences, I didn't really see a traditional path for myself anyways, because I didn't even know what that meant. And it's funny because, you know, when we talk about like diversity, right? I have a lot of people in my industry who are coaches and entrepreneurs, and they always say, you know, I love how you have such a diverse audience. You always cultivate like really like, you know, amazing people from all walks of life. And we have people who are going through cancer treatment. We have people who are, you know, learning disabled. We have people who are neurodivergent. We have people who are missing limbs. Like we have so many different lived experiences. We have someone who is a blind digital nomad advocate, right? So they're like, you have such an amazing diverse audience. How do you do that? Like I love diversity, but I just don't have a lot of diverse clients coming to me. And I had to be honest and tell them like, you don't attract diversity. You become diversity, and you become mm-hmm. diversity by the content that you consume, the people's platforms that you give access to, the people that you invite on your own podcast, the people that you follow. And so it's these micro decisions that are always like, that's the subconscious kind of frequency. So, you know, just from a diversity point of view, like my life has always been a mix of identities and a mix of different things.
That's a journey, it sounds like you've gone through. And when I think about you talking about that mix of experiences, the constant moving, living with your friend's mom, and even going through an environment where you knew this wasn't you, but you were muted, and then being able to finally, for want of a better word, like the image that comes to my very much my head is like the caterpillar to a butterfly. You kind of emerge from that cocoon out to be able to flourish. That sounds good. But when I go back to the cocoon piece, there are so many people who are stuck there. There are so many people who are in roles or jobs or doing things where they know that this is not me, or where they know that I'm being stifled, I'm being muted. I'm not utilizing the fullness of the talent that I have. And going through that process is never easy. So I'm going to double down on that. How did you awaken, for one a better word, with your rich experiences from a very young age, then going into an environment that kept you small, and then coming out of that, how did you actually make that transition? How did you go through that unlearning piece?
Yeah, so I want to stop here and acknowledge something really important, because I think this like, oh, you should just do what you love and become an entrepreneur, I find that to be a very privileged and biased thing. So I do not want your audience to think that I'm saying you should just go after your dreams, because there are so many factors involved. Like maybe you're not born in a country where English is your first language, or you don't have access to capital, or maybe you have kids to feed, or maybe like, so you know, I want to acknowledge that I come from a privileged place, right? Like, I was lucky enough to be born in the U.S. I speak English. You know, I didn't have kids to feed. I didn't have parents who I was supporting at the time. So I acknowledge all of these things. And so that's why I was able to make the decision of, like, letting go of a job. But I know that not everyone is fortunate to do that, right? So just, this is not, you know, I'm not saying, like, quit your job today. So, but I do think that it takes a lot of killing of your ego. I think I often find that what is stopping you from getting to where you want to go is just, like, enough reps. So enough cold calls, enough rejections. And I think people don't get to that threshold because of their ego, or because, so they don't ever even get to where they go, and they don't push past that threshold that's necessary for you to start taking your lessons and then channeling into something, right? They probably stop at maybe the fifth or the 10th or a 15th rejection. And we know that from entrepreneurship, or we're just speaking specifically about entrepreneurship, you need, like, hundreds of rejections, right? Before you're able to, like, make sense of the patterns and the data and, like, try to understand. And then you have to have a wherewithal to put aside your feelings and then take the data and, like, put it into something useful. So it's just a lot of learning. And I think that more than anything, for if you know that you want to be an entrepreneur, because I don't actually believe that everyone should be or wants to be. I'll give you an example. My husband is an incredible man. He's a gem of the universe. He will never be an entrepreneur, and I don't think he should be an entrepreneur. He works best when there's teams of other people, when there's structure, and he's not, like, the best, like, visionary, but he's a very organized person, right? He belongs in corporate. And thank God, because in the U.S., I need insurance. You know what I mean? I don't think that we can have two crazy entrepreneurs in the family. There would be, like, catastrophic mental meltdown every day. So thank God that he's not an entrepreneur. So it's just, like, having the self-awareness of, like, if you want to be an entrepreneur, are you willing to basically have those rejections and days when you're just like, what the hell am I doing? And just have enough of those and have the thick enough skin to be able to be like, I'm going to keep pushing. And for a lot of people, that's either not worth it or not feasible. And that's okay. So just, like, understand, like, where you are, right? But if your talent is really connecting with people, like creating something out of nothing, like having your own playbook, then maybe that's worth it, because the end goal is worth all the rejections. But you don't necessarily have to. So it's just, like, knowing where you are and, like, your personality and where your strength is. I mean, as you know, to be an entrepreneur, you are really not just an entrepreneur. You're just a salesperson. And I don't think there's anything wrong with selling, right? Selling is just creating value. But you have to naturally understand that what you're doing is not even just serving clients. Like, you are basically selling. And so I tell my husband, because he's like, you know, one day we want to move to Europe. The situation in the U.S. is not so good right now. But it's hard, because if he works for a corporate company, they probably want him in the office. And so he's explored. We've had many chats about him being a consultant or getting his own book of business. And it always comes down to the fact that he's not a salesperson. And so it's not really going to work. And so in that case, you can figure out, okay, if you want to be a consultant or a business owner, do you have the resources to hire someone to get you your book of business? Because at the end of the day, that's what it is. You're basically always advocating and talking about yourself and promoting yourself. Maybe not in a braggy way, but you have to go to bat for your company. Because when you're an entrepreneur, your business needs you to be its advocate and spokesperson. Everything else you can delegate, social media, writing emails, but, like, your business needs you to be on the front lines. And if you're not willing to do that, then you need to hire someone or put enough energy into it. And if you can't hire that, then maybe it's not the path for you.
Would you then say that there's a level of self-work that founders, people generally need to go through to help them to realize what it is that they want to do? So whether it is, I want to stay in corporate and rise up to the top of the ladder, what is it, I want to demand business, whether it is I'm privileged to do absolutely nothing at all, whatever that might be, but there's a level of self-awareness and I want to say pain that you need to go through to kind of get to that point of realization. Because if you don't get there, then it's very hard for you to be able to, like, plant your flag somewhere and be like, you know, like you just said right now, I'm an entrepreneur. I go out, I sell, I get rejected on a regular basis, but that's just part of the game. I build that resilience along the way, but I'm willing to do that because this is who I am. Someone else might be like, that is not who I am at all, but I don't know who I am. How do I find out who I am so I can have that confidence that you just kind of talked about to step forward into whatever it is I decide to do?
Yeah, I always say that life is for experiencing. And so if you treat life as, like, an endless checklist or, like, a destination, you're basically missing out on the whole fact that this is an experience. Like, we're all going to die. We're one day closer to our death. And so I think that for, especially for the young people listening, you just have to literally try as many things as possible. Like, I waited tables. I was folding shirts at Macy's. Like, I was a dog walker. And, you know, I was a personal assistant. Like, I've just done, I was working in film and TV as a producer. So, like, I've just tried so many different things. And I think when you're, like, in your 20s, when you don't have parents that you're taking care of, or when you don't have like kids you're feeding, that is your prime time to try as many things as possible. Because trust me, it's a lot harder when you're 45 and you have kids and you have parents to feed to be like, I'm going to try something new. So for the young people listening, the best leverage you have is to allow yourself to truly experience everything that you can with the time and spaciousness that you do have. That is what I would say to young people. Like, literally try everything. And the reason why I say that is because then you know what kind of environments, people, roles where you shine and that you don't like. So if you are someone who maybe likes to work with other people and loves having conversations with colleagues, then maybe leadership is for you. And that could be applied across industries. But if you're someone who likes to be an individual contributor and don't like to manage people, I am one of those people. I am not a great leader. Like, I am... probably, like, I never played sports. I'm just not really good at it. And it's my weakness, right? So, like, I'm not going to build a big team because I'm just not good at it. But my husband is an incredible leader. Like, he listens, he understands, he can see team dynamics, and it doesn't drain him. So the reason why you want to be in many environments is that you can start to gather what places makes you shine, what places make you drain, where you naturally excel. Are you someone who's a big ideas person? Who likes to take something from 0 to 100 and likes to rally people around your vision? Or are you someone that likes to be more of a team player, you know, and be more of like a mentor? So like all of those things you can figure out, but you can never figure that out if you're just stuck in one job. And the benefit of being young is that you can try many different things. I will say as an entrepreneur though, it's definitely a savage playground. It's the most radical way for us to look at ourselves in the mirror. And I'm sure you know this too, right? Because when it's your business, when it's your money, when it's your making every single decision, no one's telling you what to do. You can see all of your traumas, scarcities, insufficiencies play out in real time. And it just slaps you like really hard. Whereas when you're in corporate, like there's other people's money, right? There's other kind of buffers. And so I'm really grateful in that sense, because through entrepreneurship, through people quitting, through people, you know, giving me feedback through things not working out, I started to realize like, oh my God, like I need to improve on X, Y, and Z. And you get that real-time feedback in a really unfiltered way that can be really harsh, but it's also been the best way for me to improve. And so, you know, when we talk about like the therapy and the healing that I've done, everything that I've been taught as a daughter of a widowed immigrant has actually been the opposite thing that has helped me in entrepreneurship. Because what I've been raised with, you know, as many daughters of immigrants, sons of immigrants, is save your money. Don't spend your money, right? Play it safe. You know, all these things that entrepreneurship requires you to unlearn. Because what is entrepreneurship? Is betting, it's taking risks, right? Like going all in on a vision, investing in your business. All of these things were absolutely the opposite of what I've been taught. And it actually has withheld me from like growing in my business for many years because I was afraid to spend. I was afraid to hire. I was a micromanager. I was like, nobody wants that. And so I had to learn the hard way that basically being an entrepreneur is unlearning pretty much everything that I needed to, that I was taught growing up.
Was that where the psychedelics came into play to kind of help you go through that process of realization and then unlearning to help you become a better entrepreneur?
Oh, I love we're going there. So, I mean, you know, I feel privileged that we're having this conversation in a day and age where it's a little bit more acceptable. You know, we know that there's a lot of MDMA and psilocybin therapies that are trying to get into like formal like FDA approval. There have been a lot of successes with war veterans, you know, in terms of, you know, in improving their mental state. So it's not like a taboo, like, oh, like she does drugs, right? I mean, it is a drug. So is sugar. Sugar is a drug. Alcohol is a drug. Coffee is a drug. What is very special about plant medicine is that, A, it's not addictive. So if, you know, Michael Pollan, he has a Netflix special. He is one of the leading researchers and an Ivy League on psychedelic plant medicine. And plants like psilocybin and you know, things like MDMA, they're actually non-addictive substances. So unlike everything else, like sugar, coffee, alcohol, it's non-addictive. The thing about psychedelics is he said something really interesting in his book. He says, imagine your brain and the way that you interact with the world, right? Imagine it being like grooves in a snow mountain. So you have your slides and you go down the slide, and after a while the grooves form, and anytime you push a slide it's always going to fall into one of those grooves, right? The beauty of psychedelic plant medicine is that it puts a fresh layer of snow onto your brain, onto the snow, so that you can find new pathways. And that's really powerful, because if you think about the way that we are triggered by things that our parents did or parents didn't do and how that manifests in our relationships, right? It all comes from one way of relating or thinking about that problem. And psychedelic medicine has allowed me to really tap into another way of relating to my mom. Like, for example, I only lived 8 years with my mom, right? Because I told you I lived with aunts and grandparents. And so there was a lot of resentment of years that she was never there for me, of understanding that she just doesn't know big parts of my life. And also the fact that she grew up in communist China without running water or electricity, and I'm fully American. So there was decades of cultural, like generational, like so much difference between us that I just felt like I could never get along with her, and I didn't really understand her. Like, it didn't feel like I was of her flesh. And she was my only living parent, right? And I could talk to a therapist for years about it, rationalize, understand. But I think in terms of healing traumas, it needs to be felt like in your body. Like, safety needs to be felt in your body. Compassion needs to be felt in your body. And no amount of talk therapy could get me there. Now, I'm not discounting talk therapy. I think therapy is very important. But I think there's certain things that you go through that are traumatic experiences that talk therapy, it can only do so much. And so I'll share with you. So I'm very lucky that in New York, I have a lot of friends who are brain surgeons, researchers, psychedelic, facilitators, shamans, if you will. They're musicians. And so I'm in this world where people are constantly doing this type of work. So I have the community, I have the resources, I have the lexicon. My mom didn't have that, right? And so being in this environment, I was invited to a couple of ceremonies. And so, during that beautiful ceremony where it was sound, shamanic instruments, and, you know, there was a licensed therapist there, and we took psychedelic plant medicine. I was journaling. I saw a vision, and I saw my mom holding my little hand, and we were looking, and we were in the hospital, and we were looking at my father's dead body. And in that moment, I felt such grief, not for me and the things that she didn't give me, but grief for this woman who came to a new country, who didn't know anyone, who lost the love of her life, who then had to be in a new country with a little girl, and who never got to have the life experience that I do now. And so feeling her grief viscerally in my bones, I just let out this huge cry. And in that moment, all the years of resentment, of bottle of anger, kind of melted away, and it created this beautiful channel of compassion. And so it kind of allowed me to empty that cup that was already filled with resentment, anger, you weren't there for me, you never called me, of like, wow, like, you have such grief that you have not processed. I have a good life, but you will never be able to get that time back, right? And since then, it's just changed my whole way of relating to my mom. Now, she's still the same person. She still says things that are very triggering for me, especially when we talk about the past. But instead of reacting and being triggered and then us like yelling at each other at the top of our throats, I kind of step back and I create just 1 second of a window of silence or of stillness. And in that stillness, compassion and love is there. So I don't react as much. It still bothers me, right? She still really bothers the heck out of me, but I have like just 1 or 2 seconds of compassion that really changes how I react. And so because I react differently to her, now I fly her business class around the world. I took her to 5 countries this Christmas. You know, before I didn't see her for like 4 years during COVID. Her entire being is different. Like, she is a radiant, happy goddess. And I think it's because I finally see her for the first time in my life. So when I say that, like, when you heal yourself, you heal the world. Like, I'm a living proof. Because I healed the way that I relate to her, she has changed. Her health is better. She relates better to her family as well. So that's really kind of the high level story of my experience with psychedelic plant medicine.
Is that image that you had, which is what sounds like it's been very helpful for you to help restore that relationship with your mom, is that image there because now it's with you, it's rewired your neuroplasticity so that when you're thinking about things, you tap into that rather than tapping into your initial emotion, which might be anger or frustration that you had previously. And that's what the psychedelic has been able to help you to do, which, like you said, you can't do that through talk therapy. You have to kind of live it and feel it and have that kind of wired into your brain through that experience? Is that what it did for you?
Yeah. And listen, I'm not a therapist, so like, I'm not saying that talk therapy can't get you there, but I'm just saying for what I felt and the years of resentment that was compounded, it probably would have taken me decades of talk therapy to get there. Right. And so I don't want to discount that. And I don't think plant medicine's for everyone. I think you need to have the access to like the right set and setting. I don't think everyone should just be like doing shrooms in their living room. Right. It has to be very intentional. But it was that whole journey and then viscerally feeling her grief in my bones, where I felt grief for this woman. Logically, I understood she had a tough life, but I always came from like, this is what I couldn't get from you, and this is how you disappointed me. That even though I rationally knew that she had a hard life, I didn't feel that compassion deep in my bones. I didn't really feel it. And so from feeling her grief, and yes, I saw the vision, but I don't like keep going back to that vision. But that feeling of compassion is forever stamped in my bones. And so when I think about my mother, there's a tenderness there. There's a love that kind of is there. Whereas before it was just numbness.
Wow. I want to ask you a question around anger. And there are two sides of anger. There's what I call the good side and the bad side. And one thing that triggered me was I was looking through your research on this, and looked through something that you wrote recently. I'm going to read it out. And you said that for most of my life, I carried resentment and anger. I believed that I had to deal with it alone because I couldn't rely on anyone, especially her. That energy showed up everywhere in how I ran my business, how I treated myself, in how I couldn't receive help, couldn't trust people, couldn't slow down. I thought if I stopped grinding, everything would fall apart, because that's what I learned. Survive, push through, don't need anyone. Healing that wound really healed, or really healing it didn't just change how I talk to my mom. It changed how I lead, how I rest, how I receive, how I build. I stopped running my business from survivor mode and everything shifted. This work isn't separate from business. It is the business. And when I read that, which is such a powerful statement to write, I heard that in there, that anger that you had helped you live a life which, quote unquote, some people say was very successful. But then you got to a point where it stopped being successful and you had to do something different and go through that healing journey. And now you're living a more fulfilled life than you just were doing before when you had anger alone. But I'm curious around anger as a fuel and how someone be able to identify when anger is no longer serving you and it's instead holding you back.
Ooh, I mean, this is a big topic, because if you look at the pattern of entrepreneurs, we always have a story, right? Mm-mm. And so entrepreneurs do come from a lot of trauma. They mainly come from households that are unstable and they've experienced a lot of chaos in their lives. This is actually factually true if you look at, if you just look at like 100 entrepreneurs versus like 100 corporate people. And so I think there's something there psychologically as well. It's very profound. I would say I had anger towards her, but more than anger, I think the through line of it all was no one's coming to save me. I'm not safe. And there's not enoughness in the here and now. And so this feeling of not enoughness, right? Scarcity, however, whatever contour that is, it could be fear, it could be anger, but there's a basic feeling of like not enoughness. And it can show up in the way that we attract bad partners, in the decisions that we make. But this feeling of not enoughness created an environment where I was micromanaging, where I didn't feel safe, you know, investing in my business, where I treated my team members like robots, like I pay you, you need to do this. I didn't really try to develop them as people. And I also showed up in my marketing because it was like pressure and urgency and like 5 spots left. And I think through like COVID and everything that we've been through, it just doesn't work anymore. Like the traditional like scarcity pain-based marketing is no longer. And a lot of people in the online world are either closing down their business or like, you know, adapting, because the old rule books of marketing just don't apply anymore. And I think it's hard at first because that's like what we were taught, but it's also liberating because now we can create from a space that's truly authentic to us without having to listen to other people's playbooks. And so in my own marketing, it used to be, right, we had like the 5 marketing bros that we listened to, like do this and upsell and funnel. Mm-hmm. We know that doesn't work anymore. And so when nothing works, you need to literally just be like, well, what do I want to create? And so if you look at my marketing circa 2020, very different than my marketing now. Most of the time, I don't even talk about PR. I talk about my own journey. And it's through that authenticity and kind of showing up as like, here's what I'm navigating. I don't have all the answers. I'm just kind of in my journey. And that's what attracted people who are like, hey, I've been following you for years and now I'm ready to work with you. And so it's really interesting how like the more you become yourself, the more you're like kind of magnet, right? You attract the people who are magnetized to your story. And I think that's really the pivotal moment in marketing now is not, is this person, do they know what they're talking about? It's more, okay, I know this works, but is there psychological safety? Is there identity resonance? And a lot of times we talk about values in marketing, right? And it's like, oh, we need to know your values. And it's not just a pretty little stamp you put on your, you know, your logo. I really think values are really pronounced when I know what you stand against. Because everyone can be for love, unity, right? That means nothing to me. But especially with what's happening in this world, are you willing to take a stance? Are you willing to call out some bull that's going to get people unsubscribing you? It's like that is how your people can truly know what you stand for. And so, you know, I talk about that a lot about that, right? I talk about how living with a Black family has opened my eyes to the interracial dynamics of the U.S. and how the U.S. is now going in a direction that's completely like in the opposite direction. I got like 100 unsubscribes because I wrote an email about Trump's inauguration falling on MLK Day and the irony of that. And so I got a ton of unfollows. But then as I started building, I got like way more follows. So you're gonna go through that journey as well. But I think now more than anything, there's so much content out there that's like the same old and same old. People want to know like what you're standing against. And so I just encourage everyone to be a little bit braver if it's safe to like really just talk about how you're really feeling. Even if you don't have like a fully formed sentence or if you don't have like the solution, but like just be a little braver. Like take the moment, like stand up for something, like say what's on your mind. Because only through doing that are you going to find your people.
I think a lot of people want to do that, but they're just either scarcity of that or we've been conditioned not to speak up. Because if I speak to your point, I might lose 100 subscribers. And your brain doesn't compute that actually, yeah, if I'm losing people who are not aligned to me, I'm showing up as myself and being authentic. I want to work with people who are authentic, who are aligned to what I'm saying, because actually, if they're not, then why are we working together in the first place? All this different elements of stuff, you miss all of that. You think, oh my gosh, there's a people that I've gone. What am I going to do? So there's that fear. And see, so what you just said right now, aren't people speaking up, being brave, being real? Those are powerful words. And then like, how do you truly live that out when you're in an environment, especially with non-people I know in corporate? Very good example. I write provocative stuff on LinkedIn all the time. and there's so many people I know who would never ever engage in my post. But if I bump into them or might get a DM, oh my gosh, that was so powerful. But they are, I can't be seen to engage just in case someone sees me liking it and they start asking me questions. And that just creates a problem for me. But to your point, when I'm thinking about what you're saying, especially now with AI, there's a real requirement just to be real that people want. People don't want the robot fake because we can simulate that quite easily. You can't simulate your story. You can't fake your story. So how do you get people to recognize that authenticity really is a business attribute and it's a way we should be living and showing up anyway? Because actually the more connected we are with ourselves, the more we show up more aligned as opposed to being a caricature and performing like other people have done in the past.
Yeah. So I can't speak about corporate because like with corporate, you're bound to certain rules that you know, like certain things. But in terms of entrepreneur, because I am an entrepreneur, I do have the freedom to express myself in a more open way, right? And so I definitely encourage everyone who is an entrepreneur to be louder. But I think that for people who are afraid to speak up, I think it still comes down to that worry that like there's not enough. Because if you think there's not enough people who will find your message, you're more focused on the 100 people who unsubscribe. And so the current of it is still this not enoughness. And so the more you work on this feeling of like there's always going to be far more people who are going to find me than the people who I lose, you need to lean into that. And so I get it. When you're starting your business, you're like a McDonald's. You want everyone to buy from you. But the more that you do this work and more that you realize you're in a category of one, that you're truly epic and that, you know, people want to work with you because of you. I mean, listen, there are so many other PR coaches out there, people who have worked in agencies, people who have way more quote unquote traditional experience. But my business is thriving for a reason, right? Because people aren't just buying because of my credentials and my CV. They buy because there's something in my personality and my values that resonates with them. And I think that's where we are in marketing now. It's not so much what are your accolades and how many awards have you won. It's like, does this person get me? Is her level of weird my level of weird? You know, like, and that's a great thing for a lot of people, because then you can be yourself. So just understand that there's that like current of scarcity. And also, you know, one entrepreneur said famously, you know, your business will only rise to the level of problems that you can solve. So if you're still dealing with that scarcity and you're not willing to get a couple of unlikes and unsubscribes, then you're not going to get a big following. Because in order to get a huge platform, you're going to have to deal with a ton of haters and a ton of people who don't agree. And if you're not okay with those few people, then you're just not going to grow to that level. So again, at every level of business, there's different problems to unlock. And if you're not ready for that, then you simply just aren't at that level yet. Because, you know, people who have a big platform, you best believe they have a ton of haters and people coming at them all the time. But they're just so focused on something else that it doesn't bother them anymore. But if you have a smaller following, then it seems like it's going to be a bigger blow, right? So again, your business will only rise to the level of problems that you can solve.
Speaking of focus, how do you now define success? What does that mean to you? I know you've gone on that journey of unraveling your relationship with money, safety, self-worth, all those different elements, stuff like that. But what does success now mean to you as you look forward?
Yeah, you know, it's funny because every like financial goal I had in my business, I quote unquote achieved it, and then I became like absolutely miserable. And so I realized like my success is not on a KPI spreadsheet of, and I don't even set annual goals anymore. And I actually record a podcast about this on my own podcast, Small Business PR. I always have a word for that year. And so last year, my word was freedom. And it was like, how can I, when nothing is working anymore, right? Because the whole like online course business was crumbling, like nothing's working anymore. How can I give myself the freedom to create from a purely original place? And so I did a lot of things that were different. Like I created this sacred business experience where I had my, you know, facilitator, like shaman woman come in. We did like a cacao ceremony and it was like a part business, part woo woo. That was purely Gloria, you know? And then not having any annual benchmarks or goals. That's freedom as well. So I really gave myself freedom to create a business that I want. And then my people really resonated. I started writing emails, not because like, oh, it's Monday, you got to write an email newsletter. No, I started to just write whenever I felt like it. Sometimes it would be 2 weeks. Sometimes I'd write 5 emails in 1 week. So just not having to bound by those rules and have freedom really allowed my audience to just raise your hand and say, yes, like I am all in. And for the people to self-select, and I show them where the door is. And my business has never been more profitable because of that. I don't do like traditional launches. I haven't run ads in 2 years, you know? So all of these things that they're like, oh, you got to do with marketing. Like I don't even have like a funnel right now. Like it's just like, I just write emails whenever I feel like it. The funnel is not even complete up. And people are working with me. So I'm just doing things the way I want because I've listened to my audience and I know that there's a collective shift in general in the consumer psyche. And so, you know, I think in the beginning, like I'm not saying that the marketing playbooks don't work, right? When you're starting off, you need to have some sort of exercises in the beginning. But once you know that you're getting epic results for people, I mean, we have people getting featured like every day. I have people DMing me from all over the world saying they watched my free masterclass, got featured. When you know that your shit works, you don't need to play by other people's playbooks. Then it becomes a game of, I know all of these strategies work. I've been in all the masterminds. They all work. But what is it that I want to do in this season of my life and of business? And so that's the decision I'm constantly making. So I'm not in masterminds anymore. You know, I've learned all the funnels, all the strategies. It's about what strategy and what do I want to focus on right now?
So if someone came to you and said, Glory, I want to learn how you do things. I want to learn how you share yourself with the world. I want to be like you. Man, what would you do? What would you do? How would you teach someone that? Because it sounds very much ad hoc, just going the flow, having that ease and freedom just to write, share, create as you want.
Well, I didn't start off like that, right? It wasn't like day one, I'm like, you know, talking about politics. So I understand that in the beginning, you kind of play by the rules, right? Because you want to get that runway. You want to get some profitability. Mm-hmm. But once you realize you have repeatable track record of success, you need to learn when to let go of those playbooks. And so that's where I am now. So just understand what phase of business you're in And so obviously in the beginning, it might be scary to like just launch your business and all of a sudden be like talking about all the stuff. So I understand, right? So just like just being like cognizant of that. But there's also other things that you can talk about. But I will say in general, like the goal is not to be like me. The goal is not to do things like me, because I'm me and you're you. And your story is different than mine. And so the goal should never be like emulating like someone's story. But it's more just like, how can I be a little bit more brave? How can I be a little bit more strategic? And how can I use what I have and like channel it in a way that's going to give me that feedback? Because you're not going to get it right all the time. Like my content doesn't really perform that well. Like there are people with way more followers than me who create less content than I do, right? My Instagram doesn't grow that much. But then I realized like, well, for my business, I'm not trying to build it to infinity and beyond. Like I don't want to hire a big team. I'm not a great manager. And so it means that my business will be capped at a certain capacity. And that's okay for me, because as long as I have a healthy profit margin and I don't have to be spending all my time hiring people, which I was, I can create from a really spacious place. Cause I used to be burnt out because the model was like grow, scale, like, you know, delegate. And the more that you put people between you and your customers, the farther away you are from the core message. And for certain people, it works, right? They want to build this huge machine. They want to exit. They want people to buy their company. My business is not taking that path. I'm not trying to like exit my company, right? I just want to make impact. I want to have the freedom to be able to take time off and travel 3 months out of the year and, you know, pay people fairly and not be burnt out. And so whatever income level that will be capped at, that's enough for me. Because I have like chased that $1 million mark where it's like, gotta grow to seven figures. And I just became a really partner to my husband. I became a terrible friend. My health was taking a hit. And it's like, I realized like making that much more money wasn't exponentially going to make me happier. Because again, I don't have kids, right? I don't have like all these burdens. So for me, it's just like me and my lifestyle. And I realized that my business thrives when I feel unbothered, when I'm living life with unclenched butt cheeks, when I'm not like so burnt out and I'm just like, you know, like trying to get off the call. And your customers can absolutely feel that frequency. They can feel when you're burnt out. They can feel when you're just trying to make a sale from them. And I you know, my friend Sarah Ashman says, we all have these internet spidey senses now. You can tell if people are dead in the eyes, if people really care about what they're doing. And there's this je ne sais quoi, like this thing where it's like, when you know that people genuinely love what they do, like people will hand you their credit card. Like you can tell, right? Like I'm sure you've hired someone when you're like, I don't really know why, but I just like the vibe of this person.
Yep.
And you can only stay in that vibe when you yourself feel spacious, when you have done the work to regulate your nervous system, which by the way, it's a journey that never ends. And so I feel like the richness in my life is defined differently now. It's not top line revenue and how many sales we can make, but it's like, did I really show up for that person in the DMs? Did I help this person and felt make them feel truly seen? Like that to me matters more than like convert and like doing all these crazy webinars of trying to get people. And I just realized I don't have an endless bottomless pit of energy. I have a finite amount of energy that I can give. And I am in my most beautiful, radiant, magnetic self at this level of work, working this many hours, making this many sales. And if it means that I won't grow like 3-4x that, I'm fine with it.
It's a very different version of, I'm going to use the words, the American dream that you typically hear of, which is the hustle, go hard for it. But the part that I always find intriguing when I think about the American dream is no one ever talks about joy and satisfaction in that dream. So I'm like, a dream is supposed to be something that's supposed to move you forward and excite you. And when I listen to you describe it, like, no, I'm living a life that I want to live. I recognize that there are caps and limits to it, but actually that's okay because I'm satisfied and I'm happy with myself. And you leading with that self-peace as opposed to what the environment or people might say you should do is different and challenging and confronting, all in a good way. Because actually, I think that would make such a massive difference if people were to think about what is important to me as opposed to what do other people think I should be doing. And I think it's very, very easy we fall into that. Oh, I think everyone, I should be doing this because it's what everyone else is doing. I can put my hands up and be like, one thing about my business and marketing, I'm there looking at all these different gurus online, do this funnel, do that funnel. And so many times I'm just like, I can't even bother with this. This doesn't feel aligned to me. I don't want to do this. I'm in flow state when I'm in front of a client having a conversation with them, or when I'm writing, or when I'm on stage just sharing around our approach, our methodology, all the different elements of that makes me come alive. all the funnels and all that kind of stuff doesn't. But I also know that I need to grow a business. And I was asking myself, like, I'm always stuck between that quandary of both worlds kind of thing. And it's always very hard. But being able to be true to yourself, listen to you talk right now, just keeps on coming back to me, like, the importance of the word we use all the time is authenticity. But to live it out truly is a very good description of what you're showing us in your approach.
I think so. I want to talk about this because I think it's really interesting. We're in a place in history, I think, after COVID. I think a lot of young people are waking up to the fact that, like, working for 25 years for, like, your pension, that's probably never going to materialize, right? Because in the U.S., like Medicare is whatever running out. People are awakening to this big system of internalized end-stage capitalism. And when I say end-stage capitalism, you can see how there's no middle class anymore. Billionaires are getting richer by the day. And so when we're examining all of these things, especially with what's happening politically, people are awakening collectively. So it's not just me. I'm sure your audience feels it too, where people are like, yeah, money's nice, but what is this all for, right? Because they see the systems. And so I think collectively there is an awakening for us to re-examine. We might not know what we want to do, but we know that this whole, like, more is always better is not the case. And I grew up with more is always better. More, 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 more. When you have a four-figure launch, have a five-figure launch. Have a five-figure launch, have a six-figure launch. And that comes from scarcity, of not feeling enough. And it's funny, we record this because do you know who Tony Robbins is? I'm sure you do, right? So Tony Robbins had a podcast with Alex Hormozi, who's like the guy that, yeah, right? And so this went viral on the internet. He's this guy who's like got huge biceps and he has this nasal strip and he's just always about, like, success. And he says something, Alex Hormozi, on his podcast in his intro that's like, by the age of 28, I've had a personal net worth of 200 million, whatever, right? So this guy is, like, making us tons of money. And he sits down with Tony Robbins. And there's a part where Tony Robbins basically is, like, not tearing him apart, but, like, holding up a mirror and was like, it seems to me, Alex, that, like, you know, and Alex has, like, millions of followers. He's, like, the business guy, right? And he's like, it seems like all your life you have optimized for achievement, but not for fulfillment. And that was so interesting because you kind of see this huge buff guy soften and finally be, like, have a mirror that he usually doesn't have, because usually people are, like, dying for his attention. And Tony Robbins holding up a mirror and being like, you've optimized and achieved all these things, 200, 300, 500 million, you want to get to a billion, but what is it all for? And Alex actually kind of pauses, right? And he's like, you know, it's always about the outcome, the numbers, but if I were to be really honest, I don't feel like I have a very fulfilling life. Someone with a portfolio of 200 million saying that. And so that is, like, a wake-up call to all of us. So if you're just starting your business, you got to hustle, you got to grind, maybe you got to do some of these strategies. But once you get to a point where your basic needs are taken care of and you have some freedom, then you need to reevaluate. I think that what we get wrong is we just get on this escalator that never ends. And we never get off on the floor of enoughness. So we just keep going up, 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 up until we don't even know who the hell we are anymore. And so here's your reminder to, like, yes, get on the escalator. Yes, hustle, work hard. But once you get to a certain level, look around and maybe get off and, like, smell the roses once in a while, you know? Because I know people who have seven-figure businesses and they are not happy. Like, you can tell they are stressed out. They're, like, one thing away from, like, a complete mental meltdown. And that's just not the life I want to live. Now, if your goal is just endless amounts of money, which I honestly don't think so, because at the end of the day, you're not going to take that to your grave, right? You're not going to. Really think about why you're building this business and then optimize for that. So what is the number that you need to feel spacious, to show up for your friends, to not feel like you're like, I used to be a date night with my husband and I used to think it was such a bother. Like, he, like, booked a date night, put it on my calendar. He got a haircut. He's sitting next to me. I'm wearing sweatpants with dog hair on it. And I'm literally in the DMs trying to close the sale while he's talking to me. And he's like, you know, I've been planning this date night. You've been working so hard. You won't even look at me. Like, is this worth it? And at that point, I was like, oh my God, like, I am overlooking what is so beautiful and abundant in front of me just to chase another sale. And so I think also he's Italian. So, like, being married to an Italian is kind of a secret to abundant life, because, like, they take their time. They really savor, you know, and I've learned a lot from him too. Because growing up, like, as a daughter of a widowed immigrant, I always felt like my doomsday was coming. You know, my mom was sewing shoes, you know, in a communist, like, factory. My uncles went to labor camps. But he's like, you know what? Why shouldn't good things happen to me? Whereas I'm like, oh my God, like, if something good happens to me, like, I got to pay the price. So I'm always doing this mental math. And so it's funny because, like, before our wedding, I used to have these nightmares that, like, one of us was going to get hit by a bus or die a catastrophic death because I didn't deserve to be that happy. Like, finally, I found a man who sees me, who like cherishes me, who is my teacher, my guide, my equal. But there's got to be something. I have to pay the price. And so that scarcity wound kept showing up of like, all right, something's going to happen. Like, it can't be this, can't be like this. And so that was a really interesting thing for me to also address, is like, wow, like those scarcity wounds are like deep in your psyche.
Yeah. It's that whole nurture nature conversation, whereas so many elements of how we've grown up, how we've been conditioned, can show up in our relationships and can become a detriment in our relationships. And until we recognize that, or someone, I a lot of times our partners recognize that as well, and they hold that mirror up and we're willing to listen, it can actually become a massive problem. So listen to you talk about the differences with your husband, and you marry someone who was your opposite, which happens a lot, but it was also very helpful for you to be like, actually, it can be like this. And it took a while to get there, but you did. And listen to you talk about what a successful life looks like, and not being about money. For me, it goes back to, I use the definition all the time around difference between joy and happiness, where I'm like, happiness is very external and it can come, it can go. It's actually controlled by a lot of different factors, but actually joy is internal and no one can take that away from me. So I know, for example, for me, like if I'm with my wife and my kids, that's joy. Like wherever we are, where we're doing, doesn't matter where we're outside in the worst place on earth or whatever, we're going to have fun. We're going to figure it out because we're together. For me, that's joy and that's real. And that's the foundation of everything I do apart from my faith. And it took a while for me to get there and to realize that out of everything that you do in life, you can chase things that are external, or you can focus on what's in front of you that's internal. And that internal, I see my wife as internal. I see my kids as internal. So listening to you talk about it just kind of took me back to that point of how many people are on the hamster wheel, how many people are failing to recognize who is beside them and what they actually have, which is a beautiful thing, but it doesn't look beautiful. You definitely take it for granted because that happens so often.
Yeah, I love that. When you said that joy, I could even like picture it, you know? And I will add, I think your definition of joy is beautiful. And I would just add to that, like, joy is only real when it's shared, right? What's the point of all that if you're just gonna, what are you gonna do, like hoard material things? Like, no. And so it's just, you know, I think there are very few people on this earth who are just trying to make as much money as possible just to accumulate dollar bills. Like, there's really no point to that. It's like, what do you do with that money? How are you channeling that? Are you using that to make an impact? Are you, like, you know, putting it into projects? Like, what level of lifestyle do you need? So I think that everything we've been through collectively in the last 5 years, and we've experienced so much as a human species, we are in this collective awakening now where we are actually stopping to take a beat and to be like, maybe my father or grandfather's version for what my life should look like is not going to be something that I want anymore. And it's great because now we have resources, community, and podcasts like this to talk about this openly. And it's not a radical thing anymore. And so I think it's really great that we live in a time where it absolutely is not just like a lone feeling of like, oh, this is a shared collective emotion, collective re-examination shared by all of us.
Last question I'm going to ask you is, if I'm listening to this conversation right now and I recognize that I need to unlearn, I need to let go, I need to heal, where is the first place, based on your journey, if everyone's different, that you would recommend someone starts?
Ooh. You know, there's so many tools, right, that can help you, like somatic therapy, and there's psychedelic plant medicine. But I think the first thing is to have an awareness of like the little decisions that you make in your life. Is it from a place of not enoughness? Like, am I in this relationship because I feel like I can't get any better, or I'm afraid to be alone? And just putting it through the lens, like, is this through a lens of fear and not enoughness? Or am I making this decision from self-love and trust? And that internal kind of compass will help you start to orientate maybe how you got to where you are. Because a lot of times we make decisions, we don't even know why, right? We get stuck in these things, these loops for years. But just that simple litmus test, is this coming from a place of love or fear? you can start to kind of make sense of the patterns in your life, and then you can take aligned action, whether it's to get help or, you know, finally have that difficult conversation, or maybe say no to that social engagement so you can like rest a little bit. So it's in the little things that we do every day.
That's powerful. And start this conversation saying that we're going to have a very honest, unfiltered conversation of people who have lived it and just talked about it. And this is just a perfect example of what I talk about, or for me, leadership is all about. How can we learn from things that people like you have gone through and bring that into our lives and use that to grow? And the more we can actually do that, the more we have the multiplier of people who are looking at life and approaching things very, very differently. So thank you for coming on. Thank you for sharing your journey and your story. Where can people find you? I know you mentioned your podcast that you have as well. Where can people actually tap into that as well?
Yeah, my podcast is called Small Business PR, and you can find me on Instagram. I share a lot of things about my mom and my healing journey, many of things that you have seen. And I'm on Instagram at Gloria Chow PR. That's Gloria Chow PR. And just DM me, you know, DM me, and then we can chat about psychedelic plant medicine, about healing, about our crazy Asian moms, whatever that is, right? I'm a very open book. So, but thank you for creating space for this conversation. I feel like so often, every conversation, every content is like optimized for an outcome, whether it's for conversion or sales. And I feel like this conversation was so organic, and you created such a spaciousness where there wasn't like an expectation of how it was going to go. And that was really lovely. So thank you for that.
It's an absolute pleasure. That's what we do here. This is Everyday Leadership. We shall see you all next week.